Today's Tay Show will be on case 95 in the Hikigan-roku, in the Pienlu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 95 is entitled Chokei and Hofuku, Discuss the Buddha's Words. Engo's Introduction. Do not remain where the Buddha is. If you do, horns will grow on your head. Run quickly past the place where there is no Buddha. If not, weeds will grow like a jungle. Even if you are entirely naked and absolutely bare, and the unhindered interpenetration of mind and circumstances is attained, you still cannot avoid resembling the fool who watched the tree stump to catch a hare. Now tell me, what are you to do in order to be free from these faults? See the following. Main subject. Chokei one day said, even if you say that the arhats still have the three poisons, you should not say that the Tathagata has two languages. I do not say that the Tathagata has no language, but that he does not have two languages. Hofuku said, what is the Tathagata's language? Chokei said, how can a deaf person hear it? Hofuku said, I know you are speaking from a secondary principle. Chokei said, what is the Tathagata's language? Hofuku said, have a cup of tea. Secho's verse. Who speaks from the first principle? Who from the second? Dragons do not lie down in puddles. Where dragons lurk, waves rise when no wind blows. Oh, you Ryozen monk, you've bruised your head on the dragon gate. So I want to thank everybody for coming here on our last Saturday sit of the year and practicing so diligently. Everybody was sitting very still this morning. And, you know, as I always say, something made you get up and come to practice. This is far from trivial. It's really, really important. Something made you get up. You know, you could have slept in, but something made you get up and come here, come to the computer, come to our virtual Zendo and sit. And what is that something? So anyway, that's sort of what this koan is all about. What is that something that made you get up and come to practice? It's ostensibly a discussion of the Buddha's words. And in Buddhism, the Buddha's words are, as you might expect, really important. You know, we have been having a sutra study group every other Sunday night. And I think it's really going very well. And if you haven't given it a try, please don't feel any pressure, but you might enjoy it. You know, some people have the idea that it's perfectly okay to practice just by practicing. And that, you know, it's not necessary to, understand Buddhist teaching, Buddhist ideas, the Dharma, and so on. And, you know, that's, I think, an invitation to get lost, you know. It's definitely the case that if you practice and you work with a teacher very closely, you come to Dokusan and so on, you can make really good progress. But you know, I have to say that in my case, I got into Zen because of things I read. So I can remember being an undergraduate at the university where I went. And I was a double major in English and at some point I took a course on Buddhism in East Asia, and it was fascinating. You know, it was absolutely fascinating, and I saw pictures of Zen monks meditating and Chinese temples, and something just spoke to me so powerfully. And you know, then later I had the chance to just read on my own, and I remember reading Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, and a person who's not much read in the United States anymore, but his name was Lu Kuan Yew. And Lu Kuan Yew wrote also under the name Charles Luck, or Charles Luke, L-U-K. And he wrote these marvelous books on Chinese Chan, on Chinese Zen. So, you know, if you've had a chance to read D.T. Suzuki, he's a genius, you know. And I remember reading these books by Suzuki, Watts, and Lu. I was just blown away. It was like something. I remember reading a book by Alan Watts called The Way of Zen. And when I closed the book, I thought, this is it for me. You know, this is it. So, you know, those words were really transformative. And I think it's very helpful to study the Buddha's words. You know, there are huge numbers of words to study, and they're not all really the Buddha's words. If you feel really energetic, you know, all the early Pali Sutras have been translated into, texts that you can read. There's a man named Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a wonderful, wonderful human being. He is a Theravada monk, and he has translated much of the Pali canon into the most beautiful, readable English. And, you know, there are a number of sutras you can read. They're called suttas in Pali, a number of suttas you can read that are really eye-opening. You know, what did the actual historical Buddha teach? You know, we're not exactly sure, but the Pali sutras get us pretty close. And there's a number of sutras that are just deeply moving. There's one called the Sutra of the Noble Search, the Sutta of the Noble Search. And if you read that, if you read nothing else in the Pali canon, I recommend that you read that. It's just so illuminating. It puts so many things in perspective, and sort of lays out the path in that one sutra. You know, so it's well worth reading that sutra, and maybe sometime in our sutra study group we will actually read it. And of course, in our sutra study group also, we've read the Diamond Sutra, which is a key sutra for Zen. And we've also read the Lankavatara Sutra, another key sutra for Zen. And now we're reading the Platform Sutra. And I have to say that, you know, sometimes when I read these sutras, they stay with me. You know, they have a powerful effect. You know, the truth is that the early Pali Sutras, these were written probably 400 years, written down 400 years after the Buddha died, may represent the most most accurate representation of the Buddha's teaching. So these were sutras written down about four. Until then, everybody would recite the Buddha's words. See, they would recite the Buddha's words. So the Buddha, after he died, after the Buddha died, his followers got together and tried to reconstruct all of his discourses, which are called suttas or sutras. And that word sutra is like suture. It means thread. It's an Indo-European language. Sutra means thread of discourse. So after the Buddha died, all of his followers, his closest followers, got together and they tried to remember all of his teachings. And according to Buddhist legend, Ananda, the Buddha's cousin, had this super retentive mind. So Ananda could almost remember every discourse that the Buddha gave. And all the monks got together and they would say, okay, do you remember when the Lord Buddha went to speak to the Kalamas? And somebody would say, yes, I remember that. And they'd say, do you remember what he said? And somebody would say, oh, I remember very clearly what he said. And then they would recite. The sutras in Pali always start out, thus have I heard. So this is what I heard from the Buddha's own mouth. Right? So thus have I heard. And then they tell us what the Buddha said. And they would get together and compare notes. And actually, they would have these giant, regularly, they would have giant sutra recitation events. And this was an oral culture before it was written down. People would get together and this monk would recite this sutta, and this monk would recite this sutta, and this monk would recite this sutta. And everybody could follow along because they knew it by heart. Knew it by heart. Now, this sounds impossible, you know. But actually, the Iliad and the Odyssey were originally, if you know those works, were originally oral texts. They were recited by people who might not even have been able to read. So people had, you know, I can barely remember something, a paragraph after I put it down for an hour. I can't remember what it said. There people with well-trained minds in that period could remember millions of words in order, right? It's one of the reasons, by the way, those sutras are rather repetitive. The Buddha will say something, then he'll say it again, then he'll say it again. And that's because it's got this character of being like oral discourse. So there were these people who recited the sutras, or suttas, by heart, from memory, for about 400 years, and then they wrote them all down. And having the words, the actual words of the Buddha, was thought to be indispensable. Being able to read the Buddha's words, Buddha Vacana, the Buddha's speech, literally the Buddha's speech. And a practice from early times in Buddhism was committing the Buddha's words to memory. And it was actually like ritual practice. So even now, if followers of Pure Land Buddhism will recite sutras from lines from sutras over and over again, and it's Buddha Vacana, it's Buddha's word, the Buddha's speech. So if you repeat the Buddha's words, it begins to soak in, right? It's like it begins to soak in. You know, I once met a famous writer, and I don't know if I should say his name or not, but he's a very famous novelist, and he was a guest of the English department at Rutgers, and we went out to dinner, and he is a fantastic novelist. His prose style is fantastic, and I said, "How did you get so good? You know, how did you?" And he said, "You know how I did this? I would copy paragraphs from other writers. I would just copy them over and over and over again." And I was stunned, you know, because we always think, gee, you know, originality, you know, this is the most important thing. And he would copy, you know, paragraph after paragraph from the writers he liked. And it's like committing it to memory or internalizing it. It's like, you could say, taking it into his body, embodying the language of the writers he admired. And early Buddhists thought it was important to embody the words of the Buddha. See, this was super important. And when you take words into yourself and then you say them, they become kind of like your words. You know, it's like they become your words. And they also have a psychological effect. You know, they begin to have a your foundational, they're in this repertoire. They're in there somewhere, and they pop up, right? You know, when I was in school, we used to have to recite Shakespeare. And I remember I had to do Julius Caesar, you know, friends, Romans, countrymen. And we had to learn like 100 lines of Shakespeare and present it to the class multiple times. And I still remember that stuff. I was in the bathroom trying to remember that speech. I almost remember most of it now, you know, even now, like, you know, 55 years later or something. So, you know, committing this language to memory, or putting it in your mind and embodying it, saying it, is really a big part of Buddhist practice. It's the idea of saying it is like more thorough internalization of the Dharma than just reading it. This idea of the Buddha's words, what is the Buddha's speech, is really a key element in Buddhism from early time. And as I said, you know, there are people in their Pure Land Buddhists who recite over and over again passages from, say, the Lotus Sutra. And they will recite. So anyway, the koan is getting at this issue of reading and understanding the Dharma, and basically internalizing that and making it part of yourself, part of your identity. And as I say, this was a practice in Buddhism from early times. So you know, the thing is, though, that the Pali Sutras themselves may contain the actual words of the Buddha. They may contain the actual words of the Buddha, but some of them aren't the actual words of the Buddha. So the Pali Sutras were written down 400 years after the Buddha died. And a lot of stuff that probably isn't the Buddha's words, the Buddha Vacana, is in there. So the scholars know this because sometimes the sutras will refer to things that didn't exist in the Buddha's time. And they can say, oh, this sutra was later, it was written later. All the Mahayana sutras that we value in Zen, all of them were written long after the Buddha died. Okay, and you will meet people in East Asia who are shocked by that. You know, for example, Dogen Zenji and people like Hakuin really thought the Lotus Sutra was literally the words of the Buddha. They literally thought these are the words of the Buddha. You know, they came right out of the Buddha's mouth. You know, we know that's not true. You know, the Heart Sutra was written about the first century of the Common Era. The Lotus Sutra was written a little later. The Lankavatara Sutra was written a little later. You know, there's sort of an order of sutras. And there are some sutras that were written even later. So, you know, what you have is you have like these early Buddhist texts that were still pretty late, 400 years after the Buddha. That's around 1 century BCE. And then you have these sutras that proclaim to be the words of the Buddha. And they start out with the Buddha saying things, and people for 1,000 years have thought they were the words of the Buddha. You know, I think the Diamond Sutra is one of the greatest teachings of the Buddha, even though the Buddha didn't teach it. And I feel that way about the Lankavatara Sutra, and other sutras too, even though the Buddha didn't speak those words. They're still, in my view, Buddha Vacana, Buddha's speech. So, you know, what happened was, as Buddhism continued, people continued to practice. People continued to meditate. And society changed, right? So society's changing all the time. And, you know, teachings that would have made sense, or things, ideas that would have made sense in Northeastern India in the 6th century BCE might not have made sense to people living in cities in the 1st century of era. So you know, what happened in Buddhism is really interesting, because you didn't get this one book, this one like Bible, right, or Torah that's fixed, right? You got an ongoing project of, like, I would say, exploration and composition, right? So meditators continued to practice, and they continued to explore the Buddha's words and understand them in new ways. They wrote these down in what we call sutras. So like the Diamond Sutra is, you know, one way to think of it is these are like research reports, you could say, right? So you know, monks and nuns who are like advanced practitioners were sitting on the cushion and going into deep samadhi and exploring consciousness and exploring experience and how the mind works. And they knew the early sutras, they knew the Pali Suttas, they studied them. But they understood also that maybe those teachings weren't weren't the end of the story, right? So, you know, Buddhism is kind of unique because there isn't like a Quran in Buddhism. There isn't like a Bible in Buddhism. There isn't like a Torah in Buddhism. There's more than 100 volumes of sutras. There's sutras only a few people on earth have ever heard of. And there are these sutras. The first printed book in the world was the Diamond Sutra. It was a mass market printing that was done in China. So, you know, Buddhism is like this ongoing project of exploring reality. And the foundation are the Buddha's historical teachings. But then there's all these layers on top of that, which are added by people who are writing in the Buddha's name, right? Writing in the Buddha's name, and writing using the Buddha's ideas, but maybe taking them in like new directions. See, new directions. Now, this I think is really unusual, because, you know, if in the Islamic world, if I tried to add some books to the Quran, I would be in big trouble. That's true also, you know, at the beginning of Christianity, a whole bunch of books were thrown out. You know, that's called the Apocrypha, right? You know, they were tossed out, and the Gnostic Gospels were tossed out, right? But in Buddhism, that didn't happen. These innovations were welcome, you know. So, you know, what you could say is this is an alarming situation, right? Because you have the Buddha Vacana, the words of the Buddha. And then you have all these guys coming later, these Johnny come latelys, saying, well, I have words of the Buddha too, you know. It turns out to be like a really good thing, I would say. It's turned out to be a really good thing. Part of it is because the Dharma is not something fixed. It's something we're creating all the time, all of us, right? We're using like these tools that were given to us by our predecessors, our Dharma ancestors. And we're continuing to learn and grow. See, this is really unusual, I think. It's a constant, never-ending process. These days, people don't write sutras anymore, but they're a definitely ongoing process of exploration and inquiry and development, all dedicated to human liberation from illusion and suffering. So, it's not like there's a fixed truth. There's this process of like an evolution of thinking about reality, about what does it mean? Who are we? Where do we come from, and where are we going? Some Buddhists are uncomfortable with this idea. There are Buddhists in Southeast Asia, the Theravada people really feel that they have the word of the Buddha and it's settled, and all these other sutras are bogus. There are definitely people who feel that way, but it's not everybody. I used to have a very good friend who was senior Theravada monk, and I was invited to come to a lot of his community's events, and I would lead meditation for them, and so on. And he used to say, "Oh, you Zen people, you're so well trained." So he wasn't too uncomfortable with the Diamond Sutra. And in fact, you'll find there are Theravada people who quote the Diamond Sutra or quote the Heart Sutra and use the Mahayana Sutras themselves. There was a very famous Thai teacher who was famous for using Mahayana Sutras. It upset some of the traditionalists. But I think Buddhism has a different view of what this is all about. It's not like there's a fixed revelation. It's an ongoing process, but these are all like tools you can use, right? So, it helps to read. It might help to read the Sutta of the Noble Search. It's really beautiful and it's so illuminating. It might help. It would definitely help to read, say, the Heart Sutra, which we recite every Saturday, or the Diamond Sutra. Very beautiful. In the morning, that long sutra we recite is chapter 25 from the Lotus Sutra. See? It's dedicated to Guan Yin, Canon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, right? So I definitely think studying the sutras, Buddhavacana, is worth doing. And it's deeply moving. Like I said, in my own case, I just remember reading something on Zen and just saying that is it. And I have not thought twice about it since. It was like I knew in my deepest core, this is it for me. Studying the sutras is not enough, right? Studying, as we all know, because we're getting up on Saturday and we're going to do Zen practice. Without studying the sutras, I think you can get off the rails. You can have misunderstandings about what you're up to. So it's worth reading the sutras, but reading the sutras is like reading a travel guide, right? It's like reading a travel guide. Doing the meditation is like going to the country, going to the country. So, one of the countries to go to all my life is never been, and someday I will go to Sri Lanka. My friend, the Theravada teacher, was a Sri Lanka. He was a Sinhalese monk. And for a while I wanted to go, but they were having a civil war, and that the civil war is over now. But when I was writing my book to get tenure at Rutgers, one of the things I used to do to relax, I got this wonderful travel book on Sri Lanka. If you've ever seen those Lonely Planets travel books, they're fantastic. They're historically rich. They talk about culture. They're unbelievable. And they're so detailed, you know. So when I was trying to finish this book, I was so stressed out, I would just read this travel guide on Sri Lanka. And it was, so I would meet Sri Lankans and I'd say, oh, I know where that is. And I'd tell them, and they say, oh my God, when did you go to Sri Lanka? I'd never been, you know, I was just reading this book. I know so much about Sri Lankan history and geography and all these cities, you know, that have fallen into ruin and so on. So, you know, I faked them out, but you really can't fake out, you can't really, you know, fake yourself out, right? Having intellectual understanding is very important, but it's vitally important to go to the country, to do the practice. And I would say that when you do your practice, you should try to separate your sutra knowledge from your practice. So it's not necessarily a good thing to be sitting on the cushion and saying, now, is this what they mean by that? You know, it's better just to explore. It's like read the travel book, put it in your knapsack, and just go out and walk in the city and see what happens, right? That's the proper spirit for this. And the truth is, you know, the truth is that this is like, this is the perfect combination, right? I think, is like some study of the tradition, some study and practice, you know, them a little separate, but I would have both of them. And, you know, people will say to me, is it okay? Because, you know, it's true. When you're sitting on the cushion and you're working on your koan, please don't think, right? So you're sitting on the cushion, you're internalizing the turning phrase in your koan, you know, one hand clapping, hand, hand, hand. It's probably a bad idea then to try to think through the koan. You need to go to a place where there's no thinking. And if you start thinking in terms of what you've learned from your sutra readings, it's not necessarily a good thing. Better just to be in ushin, blank mind. But these two things go really well together. But ultimately, you know, you have to trust your blank mind. You have to trust, let the blank mind really lead, right? And in a way, that's what this koan is getting at, right? I mean, what are the Buddha's words, right? That's sort of what the koan is saying. What are the Buddha's words? The Tathagata does not have two languages. What does that mean? Well, you know, it's definitely the case that you will meet people in Buddhist countries who have studied the sutras or have a general knowledge of Buddhism but don't practice. And so, you know, when somebody dies, I mean, this is not a criticism of anybody in particular. You know, when people would die in this Sri Lankan community that I was associated with for a long time, sometimes I would be asked to go to some of their funerals. And I would talk to people and they would say, oh yes, impermanence, you know, impermanence, blah, blah, blah. They all knew the sutras, you know, they all knew but it's one thing to have an intellectual idea, and it's another to have that direct experience, right? And in fact, you know, the intellectual ideas can become an obstacle, can become an obstacle. So, you know, if somebody you love dies, you know, you can just say to yourself, oh yes, everything is impermanent. The Buddha said, everybody's going to die. You know, there's a story in Buddhist tradition about a woman who comes to the Buddha and says, you know, my husband has died and I'm inconsolable. And what can I do? And the Buddha says, go around to the village and I want you to I can't remember the story exactly, but it's like, I want you to, for each person who has not known death, I want you to put a seed in a cup, right? And of course she comes back with an empty cup because everybody in the village has experienced death and is supposed to be consoled by that. And I suppose that's consoling. But you know, it's another thing to sit down on the cushion and suddenly allow yourself to sit with that loss, right? With that loss. And when you sit with the loss, when you go into Mushin, say, and you sit with that loss, it's a totally different experience because now you can't use the language, you can't use the ideas and so on to defend yourself or wall off the experience, right? You know, when I've lost a brother and my mother and my father, you know, when those happened, you know, I could say, oh yes, it's all impermanent. You know, the Buddha went around and he said, find one family that hasn't been touched by death, blah, blah, blah. That's just discursive understanding, right? But, you know, to sit in emptiness and face that loss, you know, my beloved brother, my beloved mother, my beloved father, you know, that's a different experience. And it produces a radically different result, right? You know, you experience that loss more intensely, actually, at first, you know, and you have to work through it on a much deeper level. So, you know, you're hurting, you feel abandoned, you feel helpless, you know, you go into deep mushin and you sit with that pain and something, there's a kind of transformation. The Buddha called it unbinding, unbinding. In the Pali Suttas, he calls it unbinding. It's like you're bound up in your suffering and you know, losing my brother, I'm like, I'll never be over it. I'm inconsolable, right? It was a terrible thing. Yeah. And you know, I was bound. And you know, sitting with that, actually, it happened just before a sesshin. My brother died early March, and we had a sesshin in late March, and that was a very challenging sesshin for me. You know, and I was in bondage. And, you know, but I went into deep mushin and I worked through I untied my bonds. And at the end of that process, I was liberated from my suffering. See, that's a different process from just reading a story in the Dhammapada, right? It's a different process, deeper process. And even though Buddhism has always said it's important to study the Buddha's words, you know, it's absolutely important it's absolutely crucial to go through the process that produced those words. See? So I think one of the reasons Buddhism has not been so interested in preserving a Torah, a Bible, or a Quran, is that it has a lot of faith, a lot of confidence in the process I just described. See, we have to liberate the sutras, the teachings, the words, though indispensable, aren't adequate to produce our liberation. that it's not enough to study what the Buddha said, you have to go where the Buddha went. See? And going where the Buddha went is what we did this morning on the cushion. See? Sitting on the cushion, watching the breath going into deep mushin, and working through our koans. Sometimes they're koans the teacher gives us, and sometimes they're real life koans, like the death of my brother, or something else that's happening to you in your life. And the reason you can do this, the reason this is possible, is because, you know, we have something called Buddha mind. We have something called Buddha mind. And in Buddhism, doesn't matter what school you are or what tradition you're in, we all understand that there's this fundamentally enlightened intelligence, right, at the core of our consciousness. And that, you know, it's one thing to read the sutras, but you can go and get it from the horse's mouth, right? You can sit down on the cushion and go to the source of the Buddha's wisdom in yourself. And if you work through your obstacles long enough, you know, you have a kind of unobstructed access to that luminous intelligence. Right? That's what we're doing with koan training. You know, you can't always trust your intuition, right? Sometimes people make, you know, if you... I can remember as a teenager making some incredibly stupid mistakes, right? You know, so my intuition was faulty. I can remember as an adult making some bad spontaneous decisions also. You know, what we're doing is training ourselves by clearing away our obstacles so that eventually we have like uninterrupted or unobstructed access to that luminous intelligence we call Buddha mind. And all of those sutras that we have written, all those sutras over the 2,500 years of Buddhism, you know, come out of like people making contact with that and trying to solve like the problems of their time. So, you know, the language of the Buddha, this koan is really, what is speech, basically? What is the speech of the Buddha? What is the speech of the Buddha? Now, you could say the speech of the Buddha is the words written down in the Pali Suttas. And that would be true to a certain degree. And you could say, well, the speech of the Buddha is the subsequent research reports written down by the authors, the anonymous authors of the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, and so on. But that's what this koan calls the secondary. The secondary. See, you need the secondary to get to the primary, right? You need the secondary to get to the primary. But the primary isn't this. That's really not the Buddha Vakana. That's really not the Buddha's speech. The Buddha's speech comes from here, right? From here. So, you know, we learn how to access that luminous intelligence and trust it. At first, you know, we don't know how to access it. So, you know, a lot of early Buddhist practice is just, early Zen practice is just sitting on the cushion and sloshing around in your thoughts. You know, and your thoughts carry you this way and that, and it's like a rushing stream, you know, and you're just swept along helplessly trying to grab on a rock that'll hold you motionless. But you know, all of a sudden, at some point, you know, you discover there's like this stillness, there's this point in your consciousness. You know, and when you enter that unmoving place or point, your mind becomes blank. And it's you know, and if you're at Sashin and your legs are hurting and you go to that place, it's like your pain becomes very peripheral. It's like, oh yes, that's out there. Right now I'm at the eye of the storm that's absolutely calm and centered. And you know, that moment is like the beginning of liberation. You know, that's where people are able to access what we call mushin. And so, you know, initially we're carried along and we don't know what we're doing, but finally we get to that still place. And in that still place, the mind is like dark and blank. But, you know, it's like you have access now to your big mind, which looks dark and blank, but it's like you don't know how to access it or don't know how to use it. It's like if you've been out on a sunny day and you go into a dark room, you can't see anything, you bump into furniture. That's like the position of somebody who's just starting to learn how to activate his or her big mind by accessing mushin. Another analogy is like this. You know, there are these people who were born blind, but they surgically correct the problem and then they can see. And you know, they're like 12 years old and suddenly they can see the world. But, you know, they can't see the world the way we can. They have to learn how to see the world. So, you know, they don't have depth perception because depth perception isn't really in the eye mechanism. It's in the mind. You know, so they have to learn how to see space, the spatial relations we take for granted. They even have to learn how to see colors, apparently. You know, So they have that mechanism, but they don't know how to use it. And that's kind of how it is with Zen practice. You know, once you begin to get beyond thought and you can enter this thoughtless place, this still, thoughtless, empty place, you're actually there. You're connecting with big mind, but we have to learn how to use it. And we have to clear away like residual obstacles. So a koan will say something like, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And, you know, that can't be solved intellectually. It's a good koan because it cuts off intellection. And now, you know, you have to go through like this reformulation of the way you experience this moment. And it has to take place at a deeper level. You have to access your big mind, we say, your big mind, to resolve this question. And we don't know how to do that at first. But the more you work on your koans, the more easy it becomes to access that intelligence, that fundamentally enlightened mind, see, that everybody has. I can remember... When I was starting Zen, I think I worked on the Mu koan for I worked on my breath perception meditation koan for like 3 years or something. And I never did pass it. My teacher just moved me on because it was like I would never pass this koan. So then I had the Mu koan, and I worked on the Mu koan for like 3 years. And then, you know, I worked on another koan for like 6 months. And I remember once during a Taisho, Genki Roshi said that the most koans he had ever worked through, he did something like 8 koans in one sesshin. So he was doing one a day, right? And I thought, you know, it'll take me 50 years to do 8 koans. But you get... you begin to clear away your obstacles. In other words, your assumptions or your mental formations, your mental habits. And you begin to access that on and off the cushion more and more fluidly, more and more fluidly. And eventually there's like this unobstructed access to your big mind all the time. So, you know, it's important to say, do what we are going to do in a few minutes, which is to take the Buddha's words into our bodies, You know, we're going to recite the four great vows. Send your prayer. I vow to help them. You know, the physical world, the world of illusion is infinite. I vow to see through it all. The universe is infinite. I vow to understand it all. And the Buddha Dharma is endless. Buddha learning is endless. I vow to learn it all, right, basically. And when we recite those sutras, please, the translation in our sutra book isn't very good, I would say. You could read some other translations. You know, what really, it's important to understand the meaning. You know, we're vowing to continue to practice for any number of lifetimes, basically, and to learn everything we can about enlightenment, and to help everybody who needs help. So that's the intellectual content. But what we're really doing is activating that Buddha nature in ourselves. We're making a vow, basically, and in making a vow, we're connecting with the thing that made you get up and practice this morning. Inside you is Buddha. Inside you is Buddha. Buddha said, get up and come to practice. That's what we call in Buddhism, that's called your Dharmakaya. That's the body of the Buddha, the body of the Buddha. And when you listen to that, you know, you're changing your karma. And when you change your karma, you feel better. It's like you want to sleep in, you look at the clock, you say, oh man, you know, I don't know, it's cold, it's 23 degrees, whatever. You get up because your big mind told you to get up. You sit down on the cushion, you think, oh, my legs hurt, my back hurts, why did I do this? Then about an hour in, you go, damn, you know, I feel so much better. So listening to big mind, working through karmic obstacles and experiencing the world when you have unbound yourself a little bit, unfettered yourself a little bit. See? So it's like the three aspects of practice. Listening to the big mind, working through karma, and then enjoying life as a free person, as a free woman, as a free man. And that process can go on and on. Choke one day said, even if you say that the arhats have the three poisons, you should not say that the Tathagata has two languages. I do not say that the Tathagata has no language, but that he does not have two languages. So the real language of the Buddha is not the language in the suttas or the sutras. It's the language in here. It's in yourself. Hovuku said, what is the Tathagata's language? Choke said, how can a deaf person hear it? Hovuku said, I know that you're speaking from a secondary principle. I'm not talking about what's written down. I'm talking about what's in you. Choke said, what is the Tathagata's language? Hovuku said, I'll have a cup of tea.